Thank you very much, Professor Dr. Schroeder, and also Frau Geiger. Thank you all for coming. Forgive me for speaking in English. I could try in German, but it would amuse you, but it probably wouldn't be, after a few minutes, all that interesting. The talk that I'm going to give tonight is an offshoot of a project that I've been doing for a few years that is about Hamlet, although I'm not going to be talking about Hamlet tonight, but centrally about Hamlet in relation to purgatory, and specifically to a set of events which, because of the nature of this Kulturtheorie project and its interest in modernity, maybe I'll say a few words about as the frame or background of what I'm going to talk about tonight, because something extraordinary happened in the middle of the 16th century in England under the influence of Luther and of Calvin. Luther was ambivalent, as you probably know, about whether Fege Feuer existed, but finally came down against it. The English originally in the first waves of the Reformation were held back from a full-scale attack on the doctrine of purgatory, though Henry VIII found increasingly attractive the thought of seizing the money, an enormous sum of money, that had been given to the church for the commissioning of prayers for the dead. He tried to have it both ways, to take the money and keep the doctrine. But by the reign of his son, when a stronger Protestant, more ideological Protestant movement came, briefly at least, into power, the crucial moves were made. And very briefly, I mean, in a remarkably short time, between 1549 and 1553, fundamentally the English decided under the English, by which I mean the authorities, a really relatively small number of people in the state and church, decided that they would change the country's relation between the living and the dead, and they would make what is in effect a crucial move toward what could be understood to be a crucial move toward modernity, which was the killing of the dead as the fundamental starting point of a modernization project. That is to say, the abolition of ghosts, the possibility of ghosts. What happened was the English authorities decided to proclaim, as I say, in a fairly narrow window of years, that the whole system, the whole elaborate Catholic system of dealing with the dead through especially that group of dead, which were understood to be the largest group in the middle space between heaven and hell, the dealing with the dead through suffrages, as they were called, principally prayers and alms, obits, chantries, lights, trentals, there were a variety of other terms used for this system, that it was all a fraud, a vicious fraud, a lie, and it had to be stopped. And the way it was stopped was by the law. They broke, in this period of time, they broke most of the wills and contracts that had been written to provide such prayers. They seized the money, they shut down the chantries, and they forbade people. They passed laws that said that you could not pray to the dead because the dead, you were no longer in that relation to the dead. So they made this extraordinary, fundamental move in a very, very short period of time. So that in 1549, even in the first Protestant prayer book, 1549, when you put a corpse into the grave, the priest would say in English now for the first time, because the liturgy had been translated into the vernacular, the priest would say, "We commend thy body to the earth and thy soul to Jesus, to heaven." In 1553, when you threw the corpse into the grave, the priest was instructed to say, "We commend his body to the ground." You could no longer say thou, thy, you were no longer in an I-thou relationship, to use Buber's term, to the dead. The dead had now become an object that you were putting into the ground. Now, that's what happened officially, and there's a ongoing debate among historians about the extent to which this official history actually was reflected in popular understanding. What we know, or one piece of what we know, is that nominally, officially, this the belief in purgatory ended. And with the belief in purgatory, what ended was the very possibility of seeing ghosts, technically. Because what the Protestants argued was that there are no ghosts. What people, people continued to see specters, but the official line now was that what people think of as specters are demons, who have assumed, even if they look exactly like your mother, your child, your husband or wife, it actually is a demon taking the form of that person, because there's no way in which a ghost can come back. The only place that a ghost could have come back from was purgatory, because the church had worked out a set of schemes whereby, in effect, the dead could go on furlough back to the earth for various limited periods of time to beg for prayers from their living relatives. But that system had been abandoned, not simply abandoned, it had been banned, outlawed. And therefore, the official line was that there are no ghosts. There are many places we could go from these observations, but for the purposes simply of getting on with my talk, I will say that one place that I am interested in going is to the fact that ghosts become actually increasingly present where? On stage. That is to say, the great age of the representation of ghosts is precisely the late 16th and early 17th century, when they don't exist any longer, except as theatrical properties. And Shakespeare, above all, was the most extraordinary creator of these phantoms, these specters. There are not many of them, but the ones that are there are extremely powerful. And the one that in which I'm most interested myself, but I'm not going to be talking about tonight, is the ghost of, because it's a whole other discourse and not as appropriate, I think, for this purpose, but is the discourse that Shakespeare builds for the ghost of old Hamlet, who comes, he says, from a place, he can't say he's coming from purgatory because it would have been illegal. And Shakespeare was very good at keeping the police from being called. He knew exactly how far he could go before the police would get called. And he went very far. He often contrived to go very, very far, but he was good, better than most of his contemporaries. Virtually all his contemporaries had served limited jail sentences, except for Shakespeare. It's not necessarily in his honor that he didn't, but he always pulled back. But the ghost says, I'm here for a certain term, doomed for a certain term to suffer in terrible fires until my crimes are burned and purged away. And it's not simply that word purged, but it's that phrase for a certain term that is a key to a heavy hint that this is the middle space between heaven and earth that Christians in the Catholic dispensation had posited to exist. But it's not only Hamlet and Hamlet's ghost in which Shakespeare thinks about and uses these strange creatures that can't, by official theological doctrine, exist. He plays with the idea of their non-existence in Comedy of Errors and in Twelfth Night, where ghosts are revealed to be, in effect, false surmises. People get in a panic because they don't understand the situation they're in, and they think they might be seeing ghosts, as the characters in Comedy of Errors and Twelfth Night do. More famously, he has the remarkable figure of a ghost, the ghost of Banquo in Macbeth, where the ghost, in effect, serves as the most extraordinarily intense and powerful emblem of, not simply emblem, but embodiment, if that's the right word for it, of Macbeth's psychic disintegration. No one else sees the ghost. His wife doesn't see the ghost. No one at the dinner table sees the ghost. But he sees the ghost, and you remember he can't sit in the chair because the ghost of Banquo, covered with blood, is sitting there. But it's a different set of ghosts, the ghosts that appear in Richard III that I want to talk about tonight. And I want to talk about them in relation to certain ideological and state questions. I want to begin with two dreams of terror, dreams that were dreamt by Jews in the 1930s and brought together in a book by Charlotte Barat that some of you probably know called the Third Reich of Dreams, Dritte Reich des Traumes. The first dream is the dream of a doctor in 1934. While I'm peacefully lying on the sofa after surgery around 9 in the evening, reading a book on Grunewald, suddenly the walls of my room and apartment disappear. Appalled, I look around. All apartments, as far as the eye can see, no longer have any walls. I hear a loudspeaker bellowing, in accordance with the decree of the 17th of the month on the abolition of walls. The second dream, which comes from a similar source, Charlotte Barat simply went through psychiatric records of the 1930s to get records, to get notations of the dreams that people who were going for therapy were having. The second is the dream of a lawyer from the same period. Two benches stand in the Tiergarten, a green one and a yellow one. At that time, Jews were only allowed to sit on benches painted yellow. And between the two, a litter basket. I sat down on the basket and placed a sign around my neck in the fashion of blind beggars, but also as the authorities do with racial offenders. The sign said, "If necessary, I will give my place up to the litter." In hindsight, these dreams had a horrible premonitory power, but their significance extends beyond this power. They bear witness to the deep inward experience of malevolent absolutism, its ability to penetrate the mind in sleep, in fantasy, in the fictions that we daily and nightly create, even as it could also penetrate the body. An historical account of the Third Reich, or of any period, that any regime that strips away the nightmare in order to concentrate on the events themselves, risks missing a crucial dimension, in this case of the Nazis' peculiar exercise of tyranny. And these dreams have been powerfully analyzed, and precisely as a guide to this dimension, by Reinhard Koselleck, who I was here recently, and many of you here will have listened to. Koselleck argues that the dreams are more than the fictional testimony of terror and about terror. They are terror. They are the instrumentalizations of terror itself. Terror experienced in sleep as in waking reality, that is, had an important function in the ability of the Reich to carry out an inherently difficult program of mass murder. Difficult because so many people needed to be confused, disoriented, deceived, and made to feel absolutely powerless, even in the face of incontrovertible evidence of unappeasably violent malice against them. Of course, for the most part, the victims were absolutely powerless, but it was important for the perpetrators to carry out their crimes, not necessarily initially the notion of mass murder, but the seizure of goods and services, the denigration of humans into less than human and so forth. It was important for the perpetrators to carry out their crimes in orderly fashion to keep the greater part of their victims from attempting to resist or simply running around in mad, blind panic. There were many means besides terror for obtaining compliant behavior, means that have been amply documented in recent years, cunning lies, clever dangling of false hopes, exploitation of petty greed, the arousal of a fantasy of special treatment or unusual exemption, the lure of normal assumptions by which certain things could not possibly be envisaged because they made no rational sense. In the company of such strategies, terror had its risks from the point of view of the perpetrators, since it could trigger desperate acts of resistance. Nonetheless, it came to play an essential role in the organization and execution of the Nazi crimes, up to and including the complex scheme of genocide, since it served to block so many of the ordinary self-protective responses of conscious, sentient people marked out for suffering and ultimately for elimination, and at least partially aware that they were so marked. Many deeply terrified people seemed to act as if they were in a dream, as if they were caught in an immobilizing light, as if they were already dead. And of course, terror had the further advantage of inhibiting outright opposition or even simple, modest acts of humanity from many non-Jews, among them congenial colleagues, neighbors, friends of the victims, who were not slated for destruction. And it could also excite and attract that part of the population that enjoys the spectacle of terror. Terror is not simply dreamed, Koselleck remarks about these traces of the wounded inner lives of the German Jews in the 1930s. Terror is not simply dreamed, the dreams themselves are components of the terror. What's most striking about the dreams that I've quoted, however, is not their terror, but rather their weird, grim wit. A terrible, mirthless laughter, deeply in touch with the process by which the psychological and structural malevolence of the Nazis would eventually realize itself fully in the world. And when I read them a minute ago, several of you, I think appropriately, uncomfortably laughed. That seems to me in the stories. The sudden removal by decree of the protective walls around the individual and the whole community of which the individual is part, the radical loss of both the dreamer's professional identity as surgeon and its cultural identity as a reader of books on German high art, his reading on Grunewald, the transformation of a person into litter or something less than litter. These are visionary apprehensions of murder in the making, apprehensions conveyed as dreams so often do, with poetic deftness. The intimations of grotesque humor in several of the details, the bellowing loudspeaker with its bureaucratic language, for example, or the sign that those designated as human refuse must place around their own necks, do not detract from the terror that is in the dreams. If anything, the details intensify the terror by undermining the dignity of tragic pathos. But I think that the dreams tell us something important about the nature of the imagination under intolerable pressure, even as they tell us something about the experience of terror. Throughout the 1930s, as you know, the Nazi regime moved to transform phantasmatic representations, wildly malevolent imaginings recycled in the pages of Die Stürmer or the rantings of Goebbels, into lived reality. The dreams of the victims work as dreams by reversing this process, transforming lived reality into phantasmatic representation by means of the smallest effects of exaggeration. But this desperate, terrified attempt at reversal was continually outstripped by reality itself. By the time of the extermination camps, exaggeration itself had become virtually impossible. But even in the 1930s, reality had taken on a dreamlike horror that frequently edges toward insane comedy, particularly where the dreamers we've quoted find it in the language of decrees. And again, they're not exactly funny, but if you read the list of decrees from the 1930s, decrees that require all Jews to adopt the names of Israel for men and Sarah for women and so forth and so on, you can recognize some kind of sick humor. I recognize that it takes a strong stomach to find any comedy here, but it exists in the abyss between the formal, normative, and communitarian implications of bureaucratic rationality and a twisted authoritarianism that scarcely bothers to masquerade or justify itself, even as it's acting by decree. Well, this is a preliminary to turning to Richard III, and the way to get into Richard III from this material is to appeal to a film that many of you may have seen, Ian McKellen's interesting recent film of Richard III, which, along with a very good stage production in which the film was based, which interprets Shakespeare's play, and he's not the only one to do this. I imagine this has been done on stage a lot, and in fact, I imagine in Germany done a lot, to interpret Shakespeare's play Richard III, which was first performed in 1592 or 93, as the imagining of a monstrous state uncannily like the Third Reich. The link is not merely a matter of costumes and set design, cleverly imposed on an old text in order to confer upon it an air of modernity, although those effects are in both the film and in the stage version, and very, very well done. But the production works because Richard III is, in fact, a brilliant depiction of a radically illegitimate regime of terror, a regime headed by a twisted, perverse, and utterly ruthless monster who nonetheless exercises a weird charisma. Shakespeare's Richard capitalizes on every bit of weakness, vulgarity, greed, and fear in those around him. He's personally bold and resourceful, but he cannot do what he wants to do alone. He depends upon the frightened, foolish, opportunistic, or soulless complicity of henchmen. And though his evil is apparent to everyone, though he's the killer of children, he has, as he himself grasps and exploits, a perverted charm, an almost pornographic and vividly theatrical allure that conjoins eros and disgust. McKellen gets at this very well. It's amazing how cunning, it's in the text, I don't think it's just in the McKellen production, how cunning Shakespeare was about that intersection in depicting whatever it is that Richard has to offer, as it were. In what follows now, I propose to explore these dreams, the dreams that Richard provokes. He's a kind of walking nightmare. Excites dreams of terror in others, and he is a kind of nightmare. And I want to think about these dreams in the context of the nightmares of the Third Reich with which I've begun. But as I want to argue, terror, as Shakespeare imagines it, at once falls short of the dimension realized by the Nazis and reaches beyond the psychological and political dimension that it possesses in our own century. In Richard III, as we'll see, terror is theatrically embodied in the ghosts of the murdered. And these figures of fear hold the key to the possibility of a renewed political legitimacy, a restoration of decency, community, and hope. This spectral restoration, that is, a restoration possible only through the agency of stage ghosts, is crucial in Shakespeare's play because of the weakness of the Tudor claim to the throne. That is, because the triumphant Earl of Richmond, crowned as Henry VII, and the founder of the Tudor dynasty, that is to say, he was actually Queen Elizabeth's grandfather, the monarch who Queen Elizabeth was on the throne when Shakespeare wrote the play. He has far less right to the crown by legitimate descent than the horrible Richard, Duke of Gloucester, whom he overthrew. But Shakespeare also needs this theatrical device of the ghosts because he's dangerously identified the theater itself with Richard's charismatic, demagogic glamour. The ghosts, believable only in and as theater, are the dream of redemption not only for the monarchy, but also for the theater. Richard III seems almost innocent in its imagining of monstrous evil when it's compared with the actual accomplishments of our century's historical monsters. But there are certain significant links. I want to call attention first to the play's extraordinary current of grotesque comedy. In part, the comedy lies, as in the dreams with which we began, in the startling frankness with which malice is expressed. I don't know how familiar you are with the play, but Richard, the Duke of Gloucester, is always making remarks like this. He says he hires some assassins. And he says to the assassins, "Your eyes drop millstones when fools' eyes fall tears." All that comes out of your eyes are stones, millstones, where fools' eyes fall tears. "I like you, lads." It's that "I like you, lads" that's the very characteristic note of this play. Or again, after hinting broadly that he wants Buckingham to get rid of the two royal children in the tower, he becomes exasperated. "Cousin, thou wast not wont to be so dull. Shall I be plain? I wish the bastards dead." Very unusual, I mean, Shakespeare to have a character say something quite like that, and it always provokes a laugh in the theater. This lurid murderousness is at the same time repeatedly conjoined by Gloucester and his henchmen with the pretense of legality, a pretense that it's absolutely clear that no one actually credits for an instant. Who is so gross that cannot see this palpable device? device here means trick, exclaims the scrivener who's hired to copy the document that, like the Nazi decrees, gives to arbitrary violence the form of legality. Yet who so bold but says he sees it not? It's one of those Shakespeare moments where you think the people in the late 16th century had to have a very, very good ear for what was going on in speech, because actually, even for a native English ear, the number of moves being made in that last part of the sentence is so fast. The ironies are that actually it's hard to pick up. I'll read it again, but it's hard to get. Who is so gross that cannot see this palpable device? Yet who so bold but says he sees it not? Which is the kind of auto-cancellation for fear of what it is that you actually see. Says he sees it not is very tricky, because you don't say you don't see something, except if you've seen it. The point is underscored in the next scene, in which Gloucester and Richard are interchangeable names, Gloucester, pretending to be engaged in pious meditation, is drawn with exquisitely hypocritical reluctance to accede to an entirely fraudulent public outcry for his coronation. We're never allowed to lose sight of what's actually happening. A twisted, utterly unscrupulous, homicidal politician is seizing royal power. But the spectacle of this seizure, like the earlier spectacle of Gloucester's seduction of Lady Anne, is compelling and perversely comic. Still more important than the comedy is what I want to call the hardening of dream into history. In Richard III, as elsewhere in Shakespeare, dreams are not decorative touches or mere glimpses of individual psychology. They're essential to an understanding of power. Shakespeare, and in that sense, and Koselleck are very, very close here in thinking that you can't understand a political situation without understanding the dreams that people are having and the way in which these dreams are made palpable, hardened. One of the characteristic signs of power, and in particular of illegitimate power, is its ability to provoke nightmares, to generate weird images, to alter the shape of the imagination. Hence, Gloucester is depicted from the very beginning of the play as trafficking in drunken prophecies, libels, and dreams. And he figures centrally in the nightmares of his brother, George, Duke of Clarence, who's been imprisoned in the Tower. Clarence doesn't know that it's by means of his brother's secret contrivance that he's been arrested. He awakens from a miserable night's sleep. A night, he tells the lieutenant of the Tower, Brackenbury, he says, so full of fearful dreams, of ugly sights, that as I am a Christian, faithful man, I would not spend another such a night, though 'twere to buy a world of happy days. So full of dismal terror was the time. And then, as if under a compulsion, he tells the lieutenant of the Tower what the dream was. It began, he says, with a fantasy of escape. Methoughts that I had broken from the Tower and was embarked to cross to Burgundy. And in my company, my brother Gloucester, who from my cabin tempted me to walk upon the hatches. The hatches, the upper edge of the deck. At this point, the dream plunges abruptly, with the suddenness with which the walls fall away in the lawyer's dream, into nightmare. As we paced along upon the giddy footing of the hatches, methought that Gloucester stumbled, and in falling struck me that sought to stay him overboard into the tumbling billows of the main. Oh, Lord, methought what pain it was to drown. The details that follow make clear one crucially significant difference between the dreams of terror with which I began and the dreams that Shakespeare imagines. The former are Kafka-like nightmares of those for whom the historical process that's removing the protective walls around them or turning them into litter is fundamentally incomprehensible. The latter, by contrast, are the nightmares of the collaborators. It's not only those who are complicit with the tyrant who suffer, of course. Gloucester's rise to power with its ruthless butchery has many victims, we're told. But the innocent victims in Shakespeare's imagination do not seem to have hideous dreams. In fact, it's rather, it's a kind of utopian aspect of Shakespeare's imagination that he doesn't think that innocent people have rotten dreams. Such at least is the significance in part of the very odd glimpse of the murderer, that the murderers, Dighton and Forrest, provided the two young princes in the tower, the children, just before they're smothered. They're very strange lines. The tone is very strange. Oh, thus, quoth Dighton, lay the gentle babes. Thus, thus, quoth Forrest, girdling one another within their alabaster innocent arms. Their lips were four red roses on a stalk, and in their summer beauty kissed each other. A book of prayers on their pillow lay. Shakespeare actually is, these are not great lines. They're kind of over the top. But I think Shakespeare's going out of his way to try to suggest how sublimely innocent these children are. Clarence, by contrast, is dismally aware of his own guilt, and his nightmare manifests a queasy soul sickness, expressed symbolically as an inability to die quickly, and represented in startlingly physical terms as an inability to vomit. Shakespeare is very, very interested throughout his career in vomiting. Keeps coming up in his plays. I'm sure he vomited at least once in his life on the basis of his work. In this case, Clarence can't vomit. Often did I strive to yield the ghost, he says, shudderingly recalling the pain of drowning, but still the envious flood stopped in my soul and would not let it forth to find the empty, vast, and wandering air, but smothered it within my panting bulk, who almost burst to belch it in the sea. I can't do justice to the lines, in fact, of this whole dream. The whole dream is written with a kind of power and intensity simply at the level of language and of sound that is staggering. I mean, you need to be an actor to be able to do the very, very beautiful lines. The soul longs to find the empty, vast, and wandering air precisely because it feels the opposite, not emptiness but horrible pressure, not vastness but claustrophobic confinement, and not wandering but immobility and smothering. But when, in Clarence's dream, his soul finally does escape his body, the torment only intensifies as he encounters ghosts. The ghosts, the shades, as he calls them, of those he has betrayed and murdered. Those shades, first, he says, my great father-in-law, renowned Warwick, and then Edward, Prince of Wales, a shadow like an angel with bright hair dabbled in blood, are the denizens of a classical Hades, the kingdom of perpetual night, which Clarence has reached in his dream by passing the melancholy flood with that sour ferryman which poets write of, let's say, with Charon. And it's clear that Shakespeare is working off of Seneca, probably more than any other playwright, classical playwright, to convey the sense of the classical Hades. Maybe some Virgil in it as well. Upon seeing Clarence, false, fleeting, perjured Clarence, the murdered Prince of Wales shrieks, seize him in furies, take him unto torment. And then Clarence explains, with that, methoughts a legion of foul fiends environed me and howled in mine ears such hideous cries that with the very noise I trembling waked, and for a season after could not believe but that I was in hell. Such terrible impression made my dream. How real is any of this supposed to be within the world of the play or in the minds of the spectators? What's the status of the shadows of dead Warwick and Edward? Clarence's vision is carefully and repeatedly marked as a dream, horribly vivid but distinctly unreal. And within the general unreality of the dream state, the vision is further distanced by its use of classical figures like the sour ferryman Charon and the Furies, figures whom poets write of, he says, poets write of. And yet the distance of these poetic fictions from reality is uncertain. The boundary marking off dream space from the play's actual lived world, porous. Recognizing, as Clarence does, that it's only a dream, does not completely free him from the terrible impression that it made on him, an impression confirmed and seconded by the Lieutenant Brackenbury, whom he's telling this to. No marvel, Lord, though it affrighted you. I am afraid, methinks, to hear you tell it. If there's a little measure of reassurance in Brackenbury's solidarity, the dream would frighten anyone, and therefore it presumably need not be interpreted as a specific prophecy, a prognostication of the fate of the dreamer. The reassurance vanishes immediately with the entrance of the two murderers sent by Gloucester to dispatch his older brother. The murderers first stab Clarence, and then to finish him off, drown him in a momsy butt, thereby fulfilling in the flesh the dream's horrible image. What happens in that scene is actually a perfect instance of that hardening of the dream into reality. Clarence goes to sleep, back to sleep after he's told Brackenbury of his dream. And then at that moment, as he's asleep, the murderers come in, as if they're figures who are emerging out of the nightmare that he's just had. And then they wake him up, only to tell him that he has to wake up because they're going to kill him. And he begs them not to kill him, and then they actually begin to worry about whether they should kill him or shouldn't kill him. And then finally, one of the murderers, steals himself to do it and kills Clarence. What are we to make of this fulfillment? Later in Richard III, Hastings, another character, mocks another character's dream. He dreamt the boar had raised off his helm, only to find that it prefigures his own end. Off with his head, Richard says a few moments later. I, too fond, might have prevented this, laments Hastings when the death sentence is pronounced. Stanley did dream the boar did raise our helms, but I did scorn it and disdain to fly. Neither the murderers in the tower, acting on Gloucester's orders, nor Gloucester himself, condemning Hastings, know the content of the premonitory dreams. So there's no question of any deliberate matching of the imagined death. But weirdly, what happens is that first they stab Clarence, and then to finish him off, they drown him in the big momsy butt, so that he actually does get the death that he had dreamt he was going to get, which was to drown. Now, the murderers don't know that he's had that dream, and Richard doesn't know that he's had that dream. So what is it? By what logic do they actually give him, as it were, what he had a nightmare of? Some other kind of principle is at work, but what principle? Schiller once remarked that Richard III reminded him of a Greek tragedy, but the resemblance is not very obvious. Shakespeare's play, which is grouped in the folio with the histories rather than the tragedies, is not the tragedy of a great man brought low by a fatal flaw in his otherwise admirable character, nor the tragedy of conflicting and irreconcilable interests, the Hegelian sense of tragedy, interests all valid in themselves but unable to coexist in the world, nor the tragedy of a man brought by fortune to great wealth and high estate and then as mysteriously and abstractly dashed down. If Schiller's remark has any merit at all, it's to point to the source of the play's grim wit in the inexorable working of Nemesis, the goddess of just revenge upon a fatally corrupt elite. And the play has several characters, above all an old, rather crazed old woman named Margaret, who speak this language of the underlying metaphysical structure of Nemesis. And it's that figure that Hastings, when he's going to get his head chopped off after having heard a dream about getting a head chopped off, it's that figure that Hastings recalls. Oh, Margaret, Margaret, now thy heavy curse is lighted on poor Hastings' wretched head. Margaret's husband, the anointed King Henry VI, had been murdered along with her son Edward, and this crime against divinely sanctioned legitimacy haunts the perpetrators who are drawn into or by an inexorable, almost geometrical logic toward their just punishments. This is the kind of language that she speaks in the play. Edward, thy son, that now is Prince of Wales, for Edward, my son, that was Prince of Wales, die in his youth by like untimely violence. Thyself a queen, for me that was a queen, outlive thy glory like my wretched self. Rivers and Dorset, you were standers by, so wast thou, Lord Hastings, when my son was stabbed with bloody daggers. God, I pray him that none of you may live his natural age, but by some unlooked accident cut off. As that peculiar term accident here suggests, this logic, the eye for an eye logic, seems to operate outside human agency, independent of the will. But of course, such an account without any further elaboration would give us Richard III without Richard. It's Richard who has to be the secret agent of hell. The ideological basis for this conception of Richard's character, Gloucester's character, is older than the public theater. It originates in the reign of Henry VII, the grandfather of Queen Elizabeth, the reigning monarch when Shakespeare wrote the play, and the son of Henry VI, about whom this play is partly written. Henry VII. Henry, the Earl of Richmond, had, as I've already remarked, an extremely weak dynastic claim to the throne. It was in the interest of his faction to demonize Gloucester and to cobble together some legitimacy beyond that conferred by successful rebellion and killing of the king at the Battle of Bosworth Field in 1485. So what they did was, in the reign of Henry VII, Henry VIII's father, what they did was to get the ablest young intellectual in London, the ambitious young lawyer Thomas More, who had been a page in the household of a character who actually appears in the play Richard III, and they got More to write an account of the history of Richard III that would demonize, would make Richard the agent, would make the play not simply about abstract justice, about nemesis, but about the conniving of a single demonic figure, Richard, Duke of Gloucester. More provides many of the psychological insights into Gloucester's character that Shakespeare elaborates: self-loathing centered on his physical deformity, boldness, cunning, and malice linked to a gnawing inner sense of being unloved and unlovable, the murderous consequences of a traumatic birth, and a stigmatized childhood. So what More does is, first of all, he writes a kind of psychological history of the reign of Richard III that focuses not on the whole cultural logic of the age, but on a single nightmarish demonic agent, Richard III, who can be responsible for this, who can be stigmatized, and who can be overthrown, therefore, to try to save the state from this demonic takeover. Otherwise, it's extremely difficult to justify legally the overturning of Richard was a legitimate king. And at the same time, More continually hints at some other deeper principle of agency at work in Gloucester's life besides the psychological warping, though he emphasizes that he's a warped human being because of his physical deformity. More's account subtly blends psychological, political, and metaphysical elements and suspends the resolution of their relative weight in the making of history. He brilliantly sketches Gloucester's pathological character, but he doesn't posit this character as an entirely adequate explanation of his ruthless rise to power or his subsequent behavior as king. Rather, that character, that psychobiography, along with the physical deformity that helped to shape it, serves as a possible sign of Gloucester's position in a hidden order of things. The humanist More does not absorb human actions into a theological allegory. He's careful not to sound, as it were, like the crazy old Queen Margaret, but he continually hints that Richard is the fulfillment of a curse upon England and the agent of that curse's fulfillment. In More, as in the chroniclers who closely imitated him, historical figures oscillate between literal and metaphorical agency. They're not conceived as a mean between these poles, the literal and the metaphorical, but rather as beings that can be seen, as the interpretive occasion demands, either as emblematic agents of a transcendent destiny or as the inhabitants of a fallen world whose chief characteristic is the absence of anything transcendent. That is to say, More, and ultimately Shakespeare, was facing a question that contemporary historians obviously face in relation to the Nazi regime, or in relation to Pol Pot, or an end, I mean, many, many other regimes, which is a nightmare variety, which is what language to use, what explanatory or causal language to use that will not trivialize or political explanation, but with a psychological explanation. But he can't stay with a psychological explanation, and he can't stay with a political explanation. He also has a metaphysical explanation, but he can't stay with that either. And what he does is to try, and largely succeeds, and it's the legacy that Shakespeare inherited from him, to have all three dimensions constantly in play, never settling into any one of them. And depending on how you see it, it's either a kind of historiographical triumph or it's an incredible a juggling act or a card trick, because you can never actually pin down what Moore thinks, and ultimately, as we'll see, what Shakespeare thinks of as the origin of these events. In Shakespeare's play, as in Moore's history, the psychological exploration of Richard as Oedipal victim and as victim of a twisted body does not drive out the metaphysical vision of Richard as God's scourge, or for that matter, the political account of Richard as a key figure among a whole class of ruthless schemers. The Renaissance English theater, as Shakespeare supremely realized, is itself based precisely on a constant shifting of perspectives, a shifting reflected in the very design of the playhouses themselves, poised between flexible blank acting spaces and emblematic models of a fixed cosmos. Hence, in Richard III, Shakespeare can constantly intimate a deep connection between the history being depicted and the medium in which it's being depicted. And his Richard can operate both as a free agent, an entrepreneur in a ruthlessly competitive secular drama, and as a figure who occupies a predetermined position in a venerable morality play. And what I'm pointing to here is the significance, as it were, of the mediality itself in the nature of historical explanations. The kind of historical explanation, the kind of historical causality that you'll get for a nightmare regime in a play, and not just any play, but a play put on in this particular kind of theater, which oscillated in its very physical space between the metaphysical and the secular, is different from the available explanations that you will get in a book, or that you will get on a television show. That is to say, the media itself carries a significant part of the causal explanation that the artist or the historian can use. Gloucester has his own term for his position. Thus, he says, like the formal vice iniquity, I moralize two meanings in one word. He thus invokes a figure from medieval drama, vice. There's a character called the vice in English medieval plays, whose actions, however deliberately calculated, can only be understood with reference to an overarching theological scheme in which he's assigned a part. Gloucester's manic humor, his resourcefulness, his skill at dissimulation, will be allowed to bustle about for a term, bringing destruction and ruin to those around him, and then he'll be crushed by the same abstract, impersonal, retributive machinery that he had appeared to command. The final submission to the machinery is not, however, Gloucester's own meaning in likening himself to the vice. He is interested in the vice's ability to play with language. The vice in medieval drama was always the character who was the wittiest, the cleverest at handling language, and Richard alludes to that. I moralize two meanings in one word, he says. The vice's capacity for evil, but also his source of delight, is linked to the doubleness of words, the slipperiness of language, the ability to turn moral precepts into hypocritical rhetoric, the capacity to disclose or release something excessive in speech. In the course of Richard III, this capacity is unleashed and then destroyed, just as in an exorcism, the obscene, compelling voice of evil is called forth and then driven out. So there's a very strong ritual underpinning to Shakespeare's drama. Richard III as vice is at once Antichrist, and he's the tool of providence. He's the master plotter, and he's the puppet in a play not of his own making, the wily, exuberant manipulator of language, and the abject pawn. Through much of the play, he seems invulnerable, his power bound up with his indifference to the normal human emotions of pity and fear, his twisted body and his still more twisted mind immune to pity and decency and kindness. And the immunity enables him to be particularly cruel toward those whose survival ordinarily depends on kindness, defenseless women and children. And yet he seems, in the overarching ritual structure, to succumb to the magical weapon of the completely powerless, cursing. Throughout his career, Shakespeare represented curses like dreams as highly significant and dangerous. If they're not inevitably fulfilled, they are nonetheless always eerily powerful and disturbing, disturbing precisely in the manner of Clarence's dream, with its ghosts who are shrieking curses. Clarence does not fully understand, even in his dream, the historical reality in which he's trapped. He dreams, you will recall, not that his brother pushed him overboard, but rather that his brother stumbled and in falling struck me that sought to stay him overboard into the tumbling billows of the main. It is only in the terrible moments before he's murdered that he learns from the murderers themselves that his brother is in fact his mortal enemy. 'Tis he that sends us to destroy you here, they say to him. It's a terrible moment because he says, quick, send to my brother, he'll save me. And the murderers say, 'tis he that sends us here to murder you. Even then, the awful reality is more than he can accept. It cannot be, for he bewept my fortune. But the truth of Clarence's dream does not depend upon historical accuracy. Its truth is the experience of terror registered in the imagination. In the course of the play, this dream experience is hardened, as it were, into public waking reality, not only in Clarence's own fate, but in the fate of the entire kingdom. This hardening of dream into reality is, in effect, what Shakespeare calls history. And the dream is itself always a significant part of this history. There's no strict dividing line for Shakespeare, then. There can't be a strict dividing line for this reason, between private and public, between the bedchamber and the throne room, between the imaginary and the actual. In Tudor law, it was actually treason on the books, at least, quote, to compass or imagine the death of the king. I mean, you couldn't actually prosecute someone for imagining the death of the king unless he actually spoke to someone about it. But legally, it was illegal, treasonous, to imagine the death of the king. The peculiar commingling of fantasy and reality pervades Richard III and manifests itself in the force of dreams. Even when Gloucester is wooing, nightmares are close by, for terror is not restricted to the public sphere. When he proposes a place for himself in Lady Anne's bedchamber, the lady replies, "Ill rest betide the chamber where thou liest." He says, "So will it, madam, till I lie with you." She says, "I hope so." He says, "I know so." After she's married, Anne recalls this exchange and acknowledges that, as she puts it, "I approve the subject of mine own soul's curse, which hitherto hath held mine eyes from rest. For never yet one hour in his bed did I enjoy the golden dew of sleep, but with his timorous dreams was still awaked." It is, as these lines suggest, not only those around Gloucester who experience bad dreams, but also Gloucester himself. "We do not know the dreams of the enthusiasts, the victors," remarks Koselleck. "They dreamed as well, but hardly anyone knows the content of their dreams, how the content of their dreams related to the visions of those that were crushed by these temporary victors." Shakespeare obviously pondered this question and thought about the kind of dreams that Gloucester would have. "No sleep close up that deadly eye of thine," Margaret curses him, "unless it be while some tormenting dream affrights thee with a hell of ugly devils." From Anne's account, we can conclude that here too the old lady's curse was fulfilled, and that the victor had dreams of terror remarkably similar to those of his victims. "Never yet one hour in his bed did I enjoy the golden dew of sleep, but with his timorous dreams was still awakened." The dreams in Richard III culminate in the last act. On the eve of the Battle of Bosworth Field, Gloucester, who's now crowned Richard III, and his adversary, Henry, the Earl of Richmond, are both depicted in their tents, making last-minute plans for the morning's bloody encounter. Richard repeatedly calls for a bowl of wine. "I have not that alacrity of spirit," he tells his henchman, Radcliffe, "nor cheer of mind that I was wont to have." Richmond, too, remarks that he has troubled thoughts, and then they both go off to sleep. So you get them paralleled, they're both saying they don't feel good, they're troubled in mind, and then when they go to sleep, the two opponents have radically opposed visions. To Richard come the ghosts of those he has killed. "Let me sit heavy on thy soul tomorrow," each of them cries, bidding the tyrant to despair and to die. To Richmond, they then turn with blessings, prayers, and encouragements. The ghosts here appear to Richard and Richmond in dreams, just as they earlier appeared to the sleeping Clarence. But now they've materialized, as it were, into actors. And that materialization, that is to say, we see them on the stage coming in and speaking these lines. They're not simply reported as Clarence's dream was reported. And that materialization seems to confirm them as something more than psychic projections. I mean, to be sure, they have a psychological experience. Richmond, the future Henry VII, is buoyant, hopeful, and unafraid as a result of his good dreams. Richard is suspicious, self-hating, and terrified. But in fact, Richmond has virtually no psychological depth, and Richard's psychology is continually absorbed into the political theology we've already glimpsed. The confidence of the one character and the terror of the other are significant here, not principally as signs of character. In fact, Richard is depicted not as normally timorous, but as bold and courageous. And it's Richmond who says he's feeling a little frightened before he goes to sleep. But rather of the objective historical process. Richmond awakes from his dreams, confident and refreshed, and Richard awakes, shaking with fear. He says, "By the Apostle Paul, shadows tonight have struck more terror to the soul of Richard than can the substance of 10,000 soldiers." Political terror, the terror that Richard inspired in others, has passed through the agency of those he's murdered into his own soul. And this passage marks the imminent fall of the regime. The ghosts that haunt the characters in Richard III are the play's principal emblem of the intertwining of psychological terror, Machiavellian politics, and metaphysics. They're precipitates of fear, emblems of alliances and enmities, and elements in the moral structure of the universe, a universe that is not, the play repeatedly insists, merely neutral, indifferent, or empty. By bringing the ghosts on stage and having them address two sleeping adversaries, Shakespeare suggests that the dead do not simply rot and disappear, nor do they survive only in the dreams and fears of living individuals. They are in an ineradicable, embodied, objective power. Now, Shakespeare took the nightmares, Richard's nightmare, from his chronicle sources. And if I had a little more time, I would talk about the chronicle sources and what Shakespeare does to them. But I think I'll skip this, except to say that they are, in the sources, meant to convey conscience, Richard's conscience, understood as an objective, not simply as a psychological phenomenon. Conscience is real in the universe, and its form here are these weird dreams that Richard had, which Shakespeare makes into these ghosts. And Shakespeare's Richard immediately understands his dream as the voice of conscience. He says, "My conscience hath a thousand several tongues, and every tongue brings in a several tale, and every tale condemns me for a villain. Perjury, perjury in the highest degree, murder, stern murder in the direst degree, all several sins, all used in each degree, throng to the bar, crying all guilty, guilty." It's as if there's an objective law court. He's using the language of a law court in which the ghosts are serving as witnesses. He manages to rally and to harden his heart. "Let not our babbling dreams affright our souls," he tells his followers. "Conscience is but a word that cowards use, devised at first to keep the strong in awe." That is to say, he uses language that Shakespeare's audience would have very much associated with the sort of stage Machiavelli that they would have seen in a play like Marlowe's Jew of Malta. Shakespeare exaggerates these qualities that Marlowe associated with Machiavelli, but he also echoes and intensifies the subversive power of the figure, the refusal to credit spectral visitations, the challenge to the whole structure of conventional morality, the skepticism about theologically based claims to secular power, the Nietzschean questioning of the constraints implanted in individuals to make them obedient social and political subjects. Now, this tremendous subversive power is at once released in Richard III. It's allowed to strut around on the stage and in the imagined kingdom, and then it's defeated, in effect, by whom? It's defeated by ghosts. We could say correctly, of course, that it's not simply ghosts, but an army that defeats Richard. And we all remember the tyrant's famous last line, a horse, my kingdom for a horse. Yet Shakespeare is careful not to leave the play simply as the triumph of the stronger army or as the tragedy of a king without a horse. It's the ghostly visitation on the night before the battle that condemns Richard to destruction and confers legitimacy as well as victory on Richmond. The ghosts that appear in Richard's dream are the embodiments of the psychological, political, and metaphysical forces that rally against the unleashed, murderous aggression of the charismatic tyrant. They function as the memory of the murdered, a memory registered not only in Richard's troubled psyche. Is there a murderer here, he asks in a panic and awakening. No. Yes, I am, he says. But also in collective consciousness, the collective consciousness of the kingdom and in the mind of God. And in their mode of blessing, they function as well as agents of restored health and wholeness to the damaged community. Okay, all's well that ends well. But it's worth acting once again, just before I close, what the ghosts are, or rather what they could be for Shakespeare or for an English audience in the 1590s. The simple answer, of course, is that they're the souls of the dead. Here, some of those dead whom Richard was directly responsible for murdering, for making dead. But the English authorities of the 16th century, as I said, had attempted to alter the whole structure of relations between the living and the dead. God hath shut up that way, the way from the dead back to life. Neither doth he suffer any of the dead to come hither again. Therefore, if a man sees a ghost, as Archbishop Cranmer notes, he may be certain that it's not the soul of the dead that saith, I am such a man's soul, but the devil counterfeiteth the dead to deceive the living. For souls departed the body cannot walk here on earth. Protestantism did not allow for the possibility of genuine hauntings. After death, there was judgment, or in the case of certain strains of Lutheranism, soul sleep before judgment, and anything that looked like a ghost was either a hallucination or a demon, disguised as the soul of the departed. Now, as we've seen, the ghosts in Richard III seem to be something more than hallucination. The fact that they appear both to Richard and to Richmond, unlike, for example, the ghost in Hamlet, or Banquo's ghost in Macbeth, I mean, the ghost in Hamlet in the closet scene where Hamlet can see the ghost, but his mother Gertrude can't. The fact that they appear to both Richard and Richmond gives them a more substantial claim to reality, a claim that is important, moreover, in securing the shaky legitimacy, as I've said, of the Tudor line. This legitimizing function, which is epitomized in when they turn and bless Richmond, the future founder of the Tudor dynasty, makes it virtually impossible to take the ghosts as demons in the service of the devil. Let us say it would be impossible, ideologically, to have demons bless the Tudor line as the founding gesture. That really would have got the police called. Catholicism envisaged the possibility that ghosts could be the soul of the dead returned from purgatory. But quite apart from the fact that Protestant theologians had for more than 50 years been attacking purgatory as fraudulent, the ghosts in Richard III do not do any of the things that purgatorial spirits ordinarily do to obtain the suffrages of the living. They don't ask for prayers. They don't ask for alms. They come instead to curse and to bless. What are the ghosts, then? They're figures who exist in and as theater, figures in whom it is possible to believe precisely because they appear and speak only on stage. The audience credits their existence in the spirit that characterizes the aesthetic suspension of disbelief, or its close psychological relation, fetishistic disavowal. I know very well that such things do not actually exist, and yet, within the world of the play, such disavowal is most often associated with Richard himself. All the other characters find him repellent, menacing, lying, deformed. Everyone recognizes that he's been created with something missing. Why, if he's this figure of lack, does he acquire so much presence? Because somehow the very spectacle of lack provokes a compensatory investment in him. I know this very well, but still, and yet. And outside of the world of the play, this structure is related by Shakespeare to two things. First, to the theater as an institution, where we know very well that the actors are not the same as the characters they play, that the deaths and the lives are not real, and yet. And second, to the monarchy as an institution, where we know very well that one man has not actually been given sacred authority to rule over all others, and yet. One man is king, writes Marx, only because other men stand in the relation of subjects to him. They, on the contrary, imagine that they're subjects because he is king. The close of Richard III gives this imagining of legitimate rule, this form of voluntary servitude, a blessing uttered by theatrical ghosts. It is in absolutist charismatic states that the relations between men are fetishized. In capitalist states, relations are not fetishized. In capitalism, egoistic interest replaces fetishized relations precisely to the extent to which commodities are fetishized. Elizabethan theater is the mediator between societies dominated by the fetishism of human relations and those dominated by the fetishism of commodities. Shakespearean drama is a kind of transitional object. It represents fetishized relations, though they're relations under tremendous stress, while it is itself a fetishized commodity, though again, a commodity under stress. And I might add in closing that one sign of this fetishism is the weird independence that plays seem to assume, and Shakespeare's plays more than any other, perhaps, in English at least. That is to say, they do not seem to be relations between individuals, but relations between objects that have lives quite independent of the human creator and the consumer. Shakespeare's plays seem to have the lives of ghosts. And that's all I have to say for now. Thank you very much.
Can I take questions?